content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Anika Gal from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Glamour Magazine, 17 Magazine, and we'll start off with, Do You Know What Day Tomorrow Is? Today is December 21st. Whew! It is the first day of winter. So, let's get ready with our winter attitudes. Okay, so other than that, we are coming up to one of the biggest days of the year, of course, December 25th, Christmas Day. Last time, a couple times before, I guess I talked about Hanukkah. And today I'm going to talk about Christmas Day. So Christmas Day celebrates the birthday of Jesus Christ, born nearly 2,000 years ago in Bethlehem. The Christmas holiday is celebrated in many parts of the world. In some countries, Christmas greetings are said in this way. Danish, Gladalig Uel, Finnish, Hauska Ulua, French, Joyeux Noël, German, Fröhliche Weihnachten, Greek, Kala Christuyena, Italian, Buon Natale. All right. Well, with that, we are going to get started with today's program. And the first article is entitled, 20 Reasons It's Damn Good to Be a Woman in 2017. Not gonna lie, this year had its challenges, but it was also full of big and little moments that made us proud to be female. And this is from Glamour by Samantha Leach. All right, 1, because our future leaders will be female. Organizations like She Should Run have, and Emily's List, had 30,000 women, and counting, reach out to them about seeking local and state elected office or getting involved in campaigns since last fall. Every time a woman runs, said Nina Turner of the organization Our Revolution, she is leaving a trail of breadcrumbs for the next generation. 2. Hashtag Black Girl Magic scored at the box office. In August, Girls Trip became the first film produced, written, and directed by and starring black women to earn over $100 million. The movie takes place during a raunchy New Orleans getaway where the Flossy Posse ladies prove they could easily drink the hangover boys under the table. Of its success, breakout star Tiffany Haddish has said, I was expecting it to be good, but not this level. 3. The Bush sisters are back. In October, former first daughters Barbara Bush and Jenna Bush Hager released Sisters First, their memoir about life in the White House and proof that it's possible to grow up grounded in the political world. Glamour. My sister and I can't make a salad together. How did the two of you write an entire book? Barbara, we both wanted to get a more nuanced picture of our family into the world. After meeting us, people say, you're so normal. We agree. Jenna, although we wouldn't mind being extraordinary. Glamour, in the book you talk about how hard it was to have your dad, George W. Bush, boiled down to headlines, especially during the Iraq War. Barbara, it hurt to hear what people said about him, but we tried to have a sense of humor. When we saw a bumper sticker that said, quote, somewhere in Texas, a village is missing an idiot, quote, we were like, Jenna, where can we buy one? And she laughs. Glamour, if you ran into Ivanka Trump on the street, what would you say to her? Jenna, we wouldn't have much advice because she's in the administration, and we were college students. Sometimes we wonder, what if we hadn't had each other? It made everything more magical, and it made the awkward hilarity manageable and fun. And their book, Sisters First. All righty. 4, Women Crushed the Emmys. We've been living in the world of peak TV for a while, but 2017 marked a new feminist high, and the Emmys took note. Master of Nuns, Lena Waithe, became the first black woman to win for comedy writing for her episode inspired by her coming out story. And director Reed Morano became the first woman to win for drama, for The Handmaid's Tale. In the words of Madeline, screaming in her car on Big Little Lies, whose cast won for Outstanding Limited Series, I want more! All right, number five, Nadia Murad is teaching us courage. She was kidnapped and tortured by ISIS. Now, the 2016 Woman of the Year is telling her story. In 2014, when I was 21 years old, ISIS invaded my village, Koko, in the Sinjar region of northern Iraq. They gave the Yazidis, my people, only one choice: convert to Islam or die. We didn't convert. Soon after, residents were taken to a local school, and the men, including six of my brothers, were taken away and executed within earshot. Then the Islamic State militants turned the attention to the women and children. I'll never forget how my mother looked that day, her white headscarf pushed back, her hair wild and messy. Without saying a word, she rested her head on my lap. When one of the men grabbed me and tore me away from her, I screamed and begged. The last thing I heard my mother say was, "I'm going to die." I never saw her again. Girls like me were loaded onto buses. While we waited, a militant walked over with a weapon in his hands and asked me if I wanted to convert. I shook my head. Then he gestured back to where the older women were being held. "If you convert, you can stay." I shook my head again. The bus was eerily quiet as we drove. All I could hear were the footsteps of another militant pacing the aisles. He seemed to enjoy his job, stopping to taunt girls, groping their breasts, and laughing as though amused by their panic. Suddenly, I felt a hand on my shoulder. I closed my eyes, praying the militant would go away. But his hand moved down the front of my dress and stopped on my breast. It felt like fire. I screamed, "You brought us on this bus, you made us come, and this man won't leave us alone." A commander sneered, "You are here to be sabaya, and you will do what we say." This was the first time I heard the word sabaya, or sex slave, applied to me. That moment was the moment I started dying. Every second with ISIS was a slow, painful death. The buses took the women to Mosul, where Nadia was beaten, spit on, and burned with cigarettes. She was held in different houses for several days, then sold in a slave auction and forced to convert. Her captor immediately began to physically and emotionally abuse her, pausing only to take a call from his wife. That was when Nadia realized the most chilling fact of her captivity. The women were in on it. I thought about the families living on the streets around me. Were they sitting down to dinner, putting their children to bed? There was no way they couldn't hear what was going on. In the kitchen of the house, the guard, Morteya, and an older woman greeted us. She introduced herself as Morteya's mother. When she found out I'd converted, she said, "It's not your fault you were born a Yazidi. You will be happy now." I stared at this woman, searching for a glimmer of sympathy. She was close to my mother's age, and her body was soft like my mother's. I thought being a mother might mean more than her being Sunni and my being Yazidi. Did she know how my captor had pawed at me all night long, only stopping short of rape because I had my period? Did she know how much I missed my mother? In Iraq, every woman has had to struggle for everything, no matter her religion. Seats in Parliament, reproductive rights, positions at universities, these were all the result of long battles. Men were content to stay in power, so power had to be taken from them by strong women. Even my sister's insistence on driving our tractor at home had been a challenge to the men in our lives. And yet, when ISIS came to Mosul, women welcomed them, celebrating vicious policies that exploited women like me. They stood by while terrorists killed or pushed out the city's Christians and Shiites, people the Sunnis had lived with for over 1,000 years. They chose to stay and watch, to live under ISIS. There is no way I would have stood by and watched if Yazidis had attacked Muslims the way ISIS attacked us. No one in my family would have. People think Yazidi women are weak because we're poor and live outside the cities. I've heard people say female fighters with ISIS are, in their own way, proving their strength among men. But none of them, not Morteja's mother, not even a suicide bomber, was a fraction as strong as my mother. She never would have allowed a woman to be sold into slavery, no matter what her religion. I have heard the rare story of an Islamic State woman helping a Yazidi woman. For instance, one girl from my town was given a phone by the wife of her captor, so she was able to coordinate an escape for all the Yazidi girls in her house. But more often, I hear stories of women who were even more cruel than men. They beat and starved their husband's sabaya out of jealousy or anger, or maybe just because we're easy targets. Or maybe these women think of themselves as revolutionaries, even feminists, and have told themselves, as people have throughout history, that violence toward a greater good is acceptable. Still, I don't understand how anyone could stand by while those of Yazidis are sold into sexual slavery and raped until their bodies break. There is no justification for that kind of cruelty, and no greater good that can come out of it. If Morteja's mother had acknowledged what was happening that day in the kitchen, I would have forgiven her. If she'd said, "I know they brought you here by force," or if she'd whispered, "I will help you. I'm a mother. I feel for you." Those words would have been like a piece of bread after I hadn't eaten for weeks. But she said nothing. She left, and I was alone. I will never forget the feeling. Days later, after being passed from captor to captor, raped on a daily basis, and deprived of basic human comforts like food and companionship, Nadia managed to escape. She jumped over a wall, walked through the night, and knocked on the door of strangers who risked their lives, hiding her until it was safe to get her to a refugee camp. From there, Nadia went to Germany. I now live in a small apartment where I sleep beneath large photos of my mother and my niece, who are both gone. I wear necklaces that spell out their names and the names of the dead, and I pray every day for the safe return of the missing. I still dream about Coco, and every morning I wake up and remember that it no longer exists as I knew it. It's a strange, hollow feeling, longing for a lost place, makes you feel like you, too, have disappeared. In the beginning, after we were free again, we went to the hospital to make sure we were healthy. Some of us tried therapy, which was almost impossible to endure. We went to German classes and cooked our food and did the chores we had grown up doing, cleaning and baking bread. But without the time-consuming tasks like milking sheep or farming, or the social life that comes with living in a tight-knit community, we had too many empty hours. And the mourning never stopped. The mourning, M-O-U-R-N-I-N-G. but very slowly our lives started to feel significant again. When I think back to my own escape, the unlocked door, the quiet yard, the door I knocked on in a neighborhood that turned out to be full of Islamic State sympathizers, I shiver at how easily it all could have gone wrong. I think there was a reason God helped me escape, and I don't take my freedom for granted. The terrorists didn't think that Yazidi girls would be able to escape, or that we would have the courage to tell the world every detail of what they did to us. Every time I tell my story, I feel that I am taking some power away from those men and those women who supported them. My story, told honestly and matter-of-factly, is the best weapon I have against terrorism, and I plan on using it until those terrorists are put on trial. There is still so much that needs to be done. And this was adapted from Nadia Murad's new book, The Last Girl, My Story of Captivity and My Fight Against the Islamic State. Tim Duggan Books. All right, and we're going to continue with number 6 of the 20 reasons it's damn good to be a woman in 2017. Number 6, we won one equal pay fight. Last March, the women's national hockey team threatened to boycott the world championships if its players didn't receive equitable pay. USA Hockey stepped up. The full details were not released, and the athletes won their 4th championship in a row. It was the right thing to do for the next generation of girls that dream of playing on the national team, defenseman Monique Lamoureux-Morando said. Puck, yeah! 7. We got cool imperfections. This was the year women shared cellulite on social media and even magazine covers like our February issue above, which is, four women feel their imperfections. As Lena Dunham said on Instagram, thank you for letting my cellulite do the damn thing on newsstands. Number 8, she hunted Nazis. Elle Reeve, 35, is the vice correspondent behind the Doc Charlottesville, Race and Terror. From the protests' front lines, Reeves showed us there weren't, quote, fine people on both sides, end quote. Number 9, this chancellor still rules. In September, Germany's first female chancellor, Angela Merkel, was elected to her 4th term. On her success, the arguably most powerful woman in the world has said, quote, you could certainly say that I've never underestimated myself. There's nothing wrong with being ambitious, end quote. Some GIs are Janes, finally. This May, 18 women graduated from Army infantry training, the first female soldiers to become combat ready. Private Erilyn Donovan, 20, said, I wanted to pave the way, if not for me, for others. And that was number 10. Number 11, tennis players made herstory. It's been 3-plus decades since there were 4 Americans in the semifinals of the U.S. Open Tennis Championships. This year, 4 U.S. players pulled it off. Yeah, they were women. Madison Keys, 22, Coco Vandeweghe, 25, Venus Williams, 37, and the victor, Sloane Stephens, 24. Number 12, good men spoke out on sexism. Exhibit A, Joe Biden. On the 3rd anniversary of his It's On Us campaign to end sexual assault, the former VP, see his new memoir, Promise Me Dad, said, quote, as long as I have a breath in my body, I'm going to fight to change this culture, end quote. Number 13, the San Juan mayor kept at it. Sometimes you have to shake the tree in order to make things happen, and if that has a political cost, I will take it as long as it saves lives. And that was from Mayor Carmen Yulin Cruz on the efforts to rebuild Puerto Rico. Number 14, women took over Game of Thrones. Game of Thrones used to be criticized for its rape scenes and bare boobs per episode ratio. But now, Daenerys, Sansa, Arya, and Cersei are locked in a battle to see which dame is the fiercest of them all. Favorite girl power moment of the season? When Jon Snow bent his knee to Khaleesi to show she was the true heir of the Seven Kingdoms. You gotta respect a lady who's even tougher than her fire-breathing dragons. Number 15, it was the year of naming names. First software engineer Susan Fowler rocked Silicon Valley with a viral blog post that detailed rampant sexism at Uber, which led to CEO Travis Kalanick's ousting. Then actress Amber Tamblyn blasted James Woods for trying to lure her to Las Vegas when she was 16. And after years of alluding to harassment by a bold-faced mogul, Ashley Judd got specific in a New York Times expose by two women, by the way, Jodi Kantor and Megan Tuohy. They chronicled years of Harvey Weinstein's alleged misconduct. As the meme says, boys will be held accountable for their effing behavior. 16. Women in STEM got their due. GE celebrated MIT physicist and, quote, queen of carbon, end quote, Mildred Dresselhaus in an Oscars ad that featured little girls playing with Millie dolls and using Mill emojis. Number 17, women saved our health care. After Congress tried to pass a health care bill written by 13 men and no women, Representatives Lisa Murkowski, Republican of Alaska, and Susan Collins, Republican of Maine, put the kibosh on the legislation, assisted by the deciding vote of John McCain, Republican of Arizona. To quote Parks and Rec's Leslie Knope, ovaries before brovaries. Number 18, U.S. fashion embraces hijabs. Somali-American model Halima Aden wore one on the cover of Allure and in Glamour. And when weightlifter Amna Al-Haddad helped develop a head covering with Nike, brands like American Eagle also released their own designs. Number 19, women got behind the wheel in every country. Saudi Arabia finally made it legal for women to drive alone. Protester Manal al-Sharif, jailed in 2011 for driving, tweeted, "Today, the last country on earth to allow women to drive. We did it." As one Saudi woman wrote, "I hope all the laws would be reformed until we observe full equality between the sexes." And finally, number 20, women journalists are everywhere. If you feel you know a lot about President Trump, thank three of the key journalists on the beat who happen to be women: Maggie Haberman, Katie Tour, and Ashley Parker for the New York Times, NBC, The Washington Post, and yes, Glamour. All right, under well-being, food gifts that'll actually get used, tasty and easy, these will impress everyone, by Audrey Bruno. Food gifts have gotten a bad rap. Mason jar muffin mixes are cute, sure, but they require extra ingredients, time to bake, and just plain work. So we set out to find something that, one, has that made-with-love spirit, two, requires no prep from your recipient, and three, takes little time or money to create. The solution? Gifts anyone can use instantly, made with simple ingredients like salts and sugars, says Elena Newton, food blogger at The Rising Spoon. Try these three of her charming food gifts for anyone on your list. Espresso sugar. What to put on the card. Add this caffeinated goodness to tea or coffee. Sprinkle over oatmeal or use instead of sugar in holiday treats. Lasts three months. 4 cups granulated sugar. 1 cup finely ground coffee. Stir sugar and coffee in a bowl until combined. Transfer to an airtight container. The longer you let it sit, the stronger the flavor will be. Peppermint simple syrup. What to put on the card? Use this sweet liquid to spice up cocktails, lemonade, and tea. Store in the fridge for the best flavors. Lasts 2 weeks. 3 cups granulated sugar, 3 cups water, 2 cups mint leaves, washed, dried, stems removed, 1 teaspoon peppermint or spearmint extract. Find in the baking aisle. Heat sugar and water in large pot over medium heat. Stir constantly until sugar is dissolved 3 to 5 minutes. Boil until slightly thickened about 10 minutes. Remove from heat, stir in mint leaves, cover and let steep for 30 minutes. Pour syrup through strainer or cheesecloth to remove leaves. Stir in extract. Let cool, transfer to glass jar. And rosemary, thyme, and orange salt. What to put on the card? A great finisher for fish or chicken dishes or on a margarita glass. Lasts 3 months. 2 cups coarse sea salt, 3 tablespoons rosemary leaves finely chopped, 1 tablespoon thyme leaves finely chopped, 6 navel oranges washed and dried. And you preheat the oven to 220, stir the salt, rosemary, and thyme in a bowl, use the peeler, remove the colored parts of the orange peel in small pieces, avoiding the pith. Juice 2 oranges over a small bowl. Remove the seeds. Stir, juice, and peel into salt mixture until incorporated. Spread on large rimmed baking sheet, baking until salt is dry, about 30 minutes, stirring halfway apart. Break apart any clumps. Store in airtight container. Well, we have come to the end of our program today. I want to wish you all a very wonderful week. Make it special, as with every week, every day. Every day is a new beginning. So tell the people you love that you love them, and love yourself as well. Be the best you can be. Have a great week. I'll see you next week, and all the best to you. We've run out of time for today's episode of Teen Magazines. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Monica Gall, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleradioreadingservice.org. Today's programming is underwritten with support from the Raleigh Kiwanis Foundation. They can be reached by kiwanisfoundation.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.